Hello, this is Best Practice. I'm Richard Adie. Welcome to the show. We have a meeting, you and I, later in the program. Or rather, we're going to block out some time to talk about meetings. Stick it in your diary. Women are given a lot of messages about work. Lean in. You have unfinished business. It's our turn. They're all legitimate. They're all challenges. And they all ask women to change. Catherine Fox argues for something else. The journalist and author has been reporting on women in the workplace for a long time. In her latest effort, Stop Fixing Women, she underlines the structural bias at work and argues that it's men rather than women who need to change. So, Catherine, where are we right now in terms of gender equality?
There is a long way to go. And, you know, at times during writing the book, I was either optimistic or feeling a bit cast down. But then again, I guess I am an optimist overall because, to be honest, I wouldn't keep doing this. And I've been doing it for nearly 30 years. And I think that we can change. I genuinely do. And I think there are real signs for and calls for optimism. But when you look at the statistics, gee, it hasn't shifted much. It really hasn't. So at those senior levels, what, with 35% managers are women in Australia across the workforce, only 20% in those very senior roles, and 9 women CEOs out of the ASX 200. So not particularly uplifting. On the other hand, I thought the liberating part of this is I was talking to some very senior men who did understand this, genuinely understood it and wanted to change it.
I want to get onto that in a moment, but I'm really interested in you explaining the deficit model because this is at the heart of it, isn't it?
It is, absolutely at the heart of it. So I guess my whole thesis in the book was to build a case based on that experience that I have, to stop wasting time, money and precious attention, which we can ill afford, on trying to fix women up, you know, nearly 51% of the population, into some sort of masculine norm, which clearly doesn't apply to all men, I should add, and instead start to focus on the entire workplace and the people who can make decisions that will change that. And they happen to be men, by and large, in most of our large organisations. So it seemed to me we've turned the lens on one side and not the other. And I think that means examining the kinds of masculine norms I just mentioned, you know, what we expect from people in the workplace, long linear careers, you know, the ability to outsource the family and caring responsibilities, which is, of course, a huge factor as well. So I think male and female stereotypes are a problem here. And that's why I wanted to write this. I wanted it to be very much about data. I wanted it to be about money, the bottom line, because there's an awful lot of money being spent by organisations these days, and I think quite a lot of it's being wasted.
Well, that's it. You don't have to spend long looking at this sort of thing to realise that there's a lot of money being spent. There's a lot of boxes being ticked, to be honest, Catherine. And then you just ask a few more questions, especially when I don't have the microphone turned on, and you hear, and you've heard this, well, if only women would do a bit more, more leaning in, a bit more putting up, a bit putting your hand up a bit more, that still persists.
It does. And Richard, one of the reasons there's a lot of research in the book is to show that that's, at absolute best, that's optimistic, that just doing something on an individual basis is going to, in fact, counter the structural bias and sexism that's still around in workplaces. But secondly, it can backfire. So this idea that women should just sort of switch on their alpha male sort of switch and they'll become able to surmount all of these barriers, it's actually not true. But the other part of it is I think it's sending us backwards as well, because what we do with that is we embed stereotypes. So we continue to say to women, you're not aggressive enough, you're not assertive, you don't have confidence or negotiating skills. Now, a lot of that stuff, that behaviour that's observed, that people say that must be the case, it's actually coping behaviour for women in pretty difficult environments where, again, when they show that behaviour, they get their heads cut off.
I'm not going to defend this, but one thing I do think is that some people are genuine about wanting to achieve change, men, but they don't realise the extent of their own biases.
Yeah.
Just because something's always been done this way or as long as they can remember, and I've seen it a few times, they just... They don't see it as a problem. It's like a fish in the ocean. They're not seeing the water.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy, isn't it? Michael Kimmel, the US academic, says that privilege is invisible to those who have it. I think that's a really fantastically simple way of summing that up. Of course, a lot of men bristle when you use the word privilege because they would say, I'm not privileged, I've worked hard. What they don't realise is just by being white and male, they've got a tailwind. So you're quite right, they don't recognise it. And of course, also for them, the further up the ladder they go, the more they get this message played back that it's a unique set of skills that they've brought to the table that has led them to be a senior executive. So you're actually challenging them about something pretty fundamental, their credentials for the job, when you say, actually, you weren't competing with the entire talent pool out there. You were already part of a small and select group when you got to that point. So that's a pretty interesting message for people who've been high achievers and have indeed, you know, always been supported along the way to absorb and to understand. So they don't understand that. I would absolutely agree. So that's why I think this is taking such a long time to filter through. Plus, can I just add on top of that? Of course, when you have power and privilege, you don't like to see see any of that being eroded. So there is an awful lot of protection of that going on as well. And again, you know, that's a human thing. I'm not pointing the finger, but I just think we've got to acknowledge that as well.
Some men clearly get it, and you've already touched on the MCC group. Who are they? What are they doing?
Yeah, so the Male Champions are not the only, and I should just make this really clear. The Male Champions of Change was set up by Liz Broderick when she was the Sex Discrimination Commissioner. They're ongoing. Those bodies are set up sort of independently now, and they range from a national body to a whole lot of sector bodies. So the property sector has their own and various other parts of the economy. But there are other men, of course, who are also stepping into this space, and I think we should be careful to acknowledge that. But it is interesting to look at them because it's a phenomenon I don't think that you'll find anywhere else. It's certainly not in the UK at the moment because I've been living over there and they don't have one. I don't think there's any national body in the US, for example. So it's an interesting development. It was set up, Liz set it up absolutely on the premise that we have to go to where power is and we have to be disruptive. So she wanted to make it male only because she said women are already fighting this battle. The onus is on them all the time. I want men to pick up the mantle and to start to understand this and lead by example. So I think that as a group, they've been definitely criticised for tap dancing their way around this, that it's window dressing, that they're getting congratulated for doing even quite small things, whereas women have been fighting at the barricades for decades. I would say probably all of that is true in some cases, but the real supporters, and they're probably a small cohort, I think are genuine. And obviously the ones I've quoted in my book, Hand on Heart, I would say are the ones who are very genuine about doing this. And I think that the potential for influencing their peers is really good. So that's the reason I think it's interesting to look at the model.
There is pushback though, isn't there?
Yeah.
Not just against specifically that group, but this idea that, which is central to the book, which is stop fixing women.
Yeah.
It's a call for men to do more. And there's some pushback from men on that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think that that's very true. I think that's a sense of why should we? We're battling away. Shouldn't everyone just be picking up and fighting the cause that they have? You know, why do I have to step into this space? Somebody mentioned to me the other day from one of the large accounting firms that her CEO had spoken to a group of women about this issue quite recently and a group of only men. The women said, oh, yep, we're right on to this. What can we do to make this a reality? The men actually said to him, can you just remind us why this is an issue? So I think that level of we should never assume that this is incredibly well understood or indeed that some people want to understand it because there is enormous, I think, defensiveness around it. And one of the areas I see a lot of that is in the Defence Force, which is making some really gallant efforts to change some of the sexism in the ADF right across the three forces. And a lot of people in defence, not all of them, but a lot, are finding that hard to digest.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some sort of specific things that can be done. Recruitment.
Yeah.
Full of biases, of course. And, you know, there's that very famous blind audition work that's out there. Now, what can be done to make sure that the right person gets the job?
Yes. Well, I mean, this is not, as you say, it's never going to be perfection because there are subjectivities in every level of recruitment. And anyone who's done it knows that from the moment you get applications and go through them and make, there's a sorting process. I think some of the measures that have been taken by many of the organisations that I know reasonably well, such as making sure that there is a bit of diversity in the long list and then the short list, that interviewing panels are a mixture of people on a whole lot of bases, by the way, not just gender, of course, but age, race and so on. And then, of course, this idea of the anonymous recruitment technique, which is being used in a number of different parts of the world now, actually. The UK is using it. One of the first examples I came across was a law firm, Clifford Chance in the UK, and they
very big law firm,
and they realised that a lot of their graduates were, I shouldn't laugh, but were Oxbridge, which I suspect is not a surprise to many of us. So they actually brought it in around that. They wanted more diversity of graduates, but not just on gender, although I know that was another reason. They wanted people from a whole range of different universities, and that changed the complexion of their intake almost immediately. So that was where I first started to read about it. Then I read that it was being used in a number of civil services around the world. Mm-hmm. Look, it has its limitations, obviously. I think once you get further up the ranks, if you're looking at promoting a cohort, it would be harder to make someone's name anonymous, because I think sometimes their experience would identify them. But I think at a base level, it's being used and it's producing some really interesting results. The most recent I thought was fascinating was TropFest. I don't know if you saw that.
No.
But TropFest last year and its finalists had only 5% women directors. This year they used anonymous form of judging and that went to 50%. So that's fascinating, isn't it? And that was, very, the arts. So not an area that sometimes we would think is synonymous with that kind of sexism.
Many workplaces, as you know, will proclaim that merit is the basis for promotion, and OneWit redefines merit as men elevated regardless of intellect or talent. I'm going to let that one go through. But that argument, meritocracy, it persists, and especially in high-functioning organisations that are good at what they do.
Yes, it does persist. Isn't it interesting? It's really been held up, I think, though, and, well, it's been examined a bit more than I thought it would be, and I'm grateful to see that. So there was some research in Australia that came out last year, and a number of top CEOs, men and women, spoke about the need to really examine what we mean by merit. Is it your experience and qualifications, or is it something else? Is it something very subjective? Merit is often used, I often heard it brought up in as though it's being played off against something like target. So as soon as we put something concrete in place, a target for women in management, we're going to compromise merit. We're going to end up with people who are not capable of doing the job. I'd argue the other way around. I think you set targets, you start to look at a much broader cohort, and you're going to find different skills and potentially better candidates. But the thing about meritocracy, there's a great piece of research, which is worth just quickly mentioning. Some researchers concluded that organisations that were most vehement about their meritocracy credentials ended up being the ones that were most conservative about the people they appointed. They stuck very much to male norms. And they called it the meritocracy paradox. And they think that the reason this is the case is people relax and think, look, I work in a meritocracy. Whatever decision I make, it will be the right one. It will be the right candidate. They don't examine their biases. And I thought that was fascinating. So you actually have to intervene, male and female, we all have biases, to actually look at the decision-making process and make sure that you are, in fact, examining for merit. So always keep that in mind and remind people, you can say you're a meritocracy, but you have to examine who's getting the jobs, who's getting the pay, who's getting hired.
I want to just talk to you briefly about mentoring programs. Yeah. You've identified a bit of a problem, but there is also a kind of the reverse mentoring as well. I'm keen to talk about that. So let's start with the problem.
I think the problem is that mentoring is a fantastic idea, and in general we all know we've probably been mentored and mentored others. There's been a real sort of appetite for programs, mentoring programs for senior women, with the aim of getting them into more senior roles in organisations. On that basis, I think it's time to re-examine. I don't think that's actually been incredibly helpful. I think it was a bit of a ticker box move by a lot of organisations. Oh, we're getting a bit of pressure on diversity. Let's put some mentoring in for senior women. To me, it's a classic example of using the deficit model and thinking we can kind of fix them up. Here's an experienced, usually man, because we know statistically most of the experienced people will be men. He'll tell you how it all works, give you the keys to the kingdom, and off you go. It'll be fine. Now, I know women who've been mentored at senior levels and they swear by it. They said it was fantastic, opened up a network to them they wouldn't have had. That's great. I think that broadly, though, we still haven't seen that uptick in the number of women going up into those senior levels. The problems I identify is I still think the model's troublesome, that the senior man knows and understands workplaces, that they can hand down this information, that the woman has to sit around and absorb that and make all those changes instead of looking at how these barriers are actually very tangible and need to be changed. So I think reverse mentoring is a fascinating example because this is the idea that you might even match up some relatively junior, maybe even a graduate, a woman graduate, with a senior man to try and explain to him some of the stuff that they are encountering. Because can I just tell you, there's numerous examples in the book, the penny dropping moment for a lot of the men that I've interviewed, including famously David Morrison, the Chief of Army, was when they sat down and heard what women were encountering. And they heard it in a very personal way. And it was pivotal. It absolutely changed their attitude. And I think that that's not hard to understand. I think that we really do respond to stories and individual stories. And I think that I'm not quite sure how we can convert that into something we can do in organisations more often. But I do think that's absolutely key. We need to get people to understand these are individuals. This could be your sister, your mother, your daughter. This is what's happening to them. They're not making it up. It's not out to get you. This is what happens in workplaces. And I think David Morrison would say that was his road to Damascus moment, and it completely changed his outlook.
Well, there's a lot of stories. There's a lot of data in the book as well. It makes me think it can be done. There's still a bit to do. Thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you, Richard. And that's high praise indeed.
Journalist and author Catherine Fox. Her book is Stop Fixing Women, and you'll find details on the Best Practice homepage at abc.net.au/rn. This is Best Practice on RN, the ABC radio app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adie. Thinking about work last week, how many meetings did you have? Okay, how many of them were worthwhile or productive? Right. Meetings are unavoidable. They're part of life. But you're not alone in feeling that some are a waste of time. Microsoft surveyed 38,000 people in over 200 countries. Ian Hopkins from consultancy firm Potomac Asia Pacific joins me now. Ian, what did they find?
Richard, I'll mention just three key findings. Employees worked an average of 45 hours a week, and considered 17 of those hours to be unproductive, that is 40% of their time unproductive. As far as meetings are concerned, employees spent 5.6 hours a week on average in meetings. That's 12.4% of their time. But the really astounding figure is that about 70% of respondents felt that meetings weren't productive. In another survey, 92% of respondents confessed to multitasking during meetings. 41% admitted to multitasking often or all of the time. And 69% admitted to checking email. And 49% admitted to doing other unrelated work.
They're a depressing set of numbers taken together, aren't they? Because it means that most people who go to meetings more or less think they're a waste of time.
Exactly. Yes, they do. And we've all been in those meetings.
I've sat in meetings, and at the end of it, you're still not sure what the objective of the meeting was.
That's why it's so important for the leader to make sure that everyone understands the purpose of the meeting and how it relates to board strategy.
You've kind of gone further with this. Rather than just shrug and say, well, you know, that's the way of the world, you've taken a close look at the hidden costs of this. What are they?
Well, the costs of meetings are hidden because they don't appear in any line item in the company accounts. So if we take the numbers that we've just mentioned, 5.6 meeting hours a week, 70% of that time being wasted, that means about 4 wasted hours per week. Now that 4 wasted hours represents about 8.7% of the employee's total time. In other words, a cost of 8.7% of their salary. If we take, for an example, an organisation with 100 employees with average salaries of $100,000, including on costs, the unproductive hours have a cost of about $870,000 per year. But more than that, surveys more recent than the Microsoft survey that we're talking about tell us that the time allocated to meetings has actually been increasing year on year. So our estimate of time spent in meetings and wasted hours is likely to be an underestimate. But the surveys also tell us that the more senior you are, the more time you spend in meetings. So our figure for cost per hour is also likely to be an underestimate and potentially a large underestimate.
Oh, gee, it's really starting to add up now. And of course, I don't want to dig into it too far, but you've got the time spent preparing the agenda and the meeting papers, if there are any, cost of any materials, any overhead costs for the facilities, for the length of the meeting. If you get a facilitator in, he or she's going to be money. If it's an offsite, you've got travel and meals and accommodation and miscellaneous expenses.
Correct. So it's important to take all those costs into account, particularly the hours spent in preparing agendas and meeting papers. It'd be very interesting to get a handle on that figure.
What do we know, Ian, about, I suppose, the downstream effects of unproductive meetings? So not with just what happens or doesn't happen in the meeting, but what happens or doesn't happen afterwards.
This is where it gets really interesting, because an important function of meetings is to motivate employees, to give them clarity of purpose and to develop positive working relationships. So unproductive meetings can demotivate employees and so reduce their productivity even when they're not in meetings. So the other hours not in meetings might amount to that 34 to 40 hours per week. And that is potentially the biggest single cost of meetings. And the fact that it's hard to measure doesn't make it less real.
So what we have from what you're saying, and I'm completely prepared to believe you, we have a lot of wasted time, a lot of unproductive meetings, and we can, to an extent, get some handle on the costs, but really they're almost certainly bigger than the numbers you've been talking about. And then we get this kind of ripple effect of unproductive people because they've been demotivated by these unproductive meetings.
Correct, yes. So it's a multiplicative effect.
Okay, so what can we do?
What we can do is try to make unproductive meetings productive. You know, for instance, just getting the basics right as a starting point. Things like the timely distribution of agenda and agenda papers, minutes and action items, starting and ending a meeting on time. Then there's the capacity of the chair to make sure that everyone makes a contribution, be inclusive and set a positive tone. There's behavioural aspects, clarity of purpose and clarity of role. Sometimes deficiencies in organisation structure can affect meeting performance. A related aspect, taking a broader view, meetings are a mechanism for the board strategy being implemented. Meetings are where strategy is translated into action items. So that's the top-down look at it. But another important function of meetings is to provide information from the bottom up so that ultimately the board is better informed and can adjust its strategy accordingly.
So from what you're saying, what we need to do, what more organisations need to do, is take meetings seriously, put effort into getting them to work, and making sure that the culture of the workplace says meetings will be effective, they'll run to time, and this is what we're going to get out of them.
Yes, well, of course, culture is a result of good meetings. But the other way to look at it is that, okay, if 70% of employees find meetings unproductive, then there is enormous opportunity for improvement. And touching on what you said before, I think that there's just a need to actually focus on the cost of meetings. And I don't think that's what most organisations actually do. But what you really need to do is to diagnose the deficiencies in meeting productivity and develop a plan to improve that performance. But it must start at board level and work its way down, because the board can define the most articulate and visionary statement of strategy, but their implementation of that strategy can be undermined by unproductive meetings at management and project levels.
And I do think that there is a kind of good news, bad news way of looking at this. Thank you very much for joining me today.
A pleasure.
Ian Hopkins is with Potomac Asia Pacific. You'll find a link to his article, The Hidden Cost of Meetings, on the Best Practice homepage at abc.net.au/rn. That's it for this week. Thanks to producer Ian Coombe and sound engineer Lila Schunner. I'm Richard Adie.